Good evening, everybody. I think we can start. Welcome to this seminar by the Hellenic Observatory. It is a great pleasure to be welcoming Theofanis Xaragtoulos to speak in today's seminar. Theofanis is a long-term friend of the Hellenic Observatory, and he has also a strong link to the European Institute here at LSE, where the Hellenic Observatory is based. Theofanis is a senior lecturer of European politics at the University of Surrey. He's also currently visiting professor at the College of Europe. He has a PhD in politics from the University of Exeter, but previously, before that, he was here at the Masters in the Political Economy of Europe here at the European Institute, and we know each other since then. Prior to that, he did his BA in Economics and International Relations at Tufts University in the US. His work is quite diverse. It covers topics of Europeanization, public policy reforms, the politics of crisis and austerity, the link between populism and public emotional economy, and with a specific focus on Greece. He is co-editor of the annual review series of the General Common Market Studies and co-convenes the Standing Group of Political Methodology at the European Consortium of Political Research since 2015. He's worked on Greece in a consultancy role also with the World Bank, and he's published in a range of public policy and politics journals, including the Journal of Common Market Studies, the Journal of European Integration, Policy and Politics, and others, and also authored books for Oxford University Press and other publishers. He also has wide media experience, and he's commented on the Greek crisis in Greek and British or international media, partly, I think, also relating to the work that you're going to talk to us about today. So the title of the seminar is What Drives People to Accept or Resist Austerity? Evidence from a Survey Experiment in Greece. We will have time for questions and answers at the end of the seminar. Before I pass the floor to Theofanis, as to say that the event is audio recorded and will be available online for public consumption as a podcast on the LSE website. And if you use Twitter, the hashtag for the event is hashtag LSE Greece. Okay, so Theofani, very welcome. The floor is yours.
Right, thank you very much, Vasily. It is a great pleasure to be here. I'll be standing there so I can control some of the PowerPoint there. And first of all, I would like to thank the Hellenic Observatory for inviting me over, and thank you to all of you who came in today. I was really looking forward to presenting part of this work. Now, we start off with this big question: what drives people to accept or resist austerity? And in all fairness, this is part of a larger project that I've been working with my colleague Roulanesi, who is in the audience today. It covers not only the acceptance or resistance to austerity, but also the emotional side of austerity, but also emotions in public policy. So it is a wider research agenda, and this is only one of the three or four outputs that we are currently planning out of this project. Now, we all know the story, or most of the story. We've been either communicants of the whole story, we lived through it, or we found out about it in the hard way. But in essence, we know that during the financial crisis in Europe, which we locate around 2008-2009, we had a bit of an upheaval in the political system, which, as a result of the financial crisis, a lot of the right-wing parties managed to capitalize on this crisis, whereas the left did not manage to do so. In the case of the left, we only have one exception that has made it really big into government at some point, and that was Greece. Now, we all know that Syriza came to power after successive collapses of government, but also the collapse of the center-left party, PASOK, as the main center-left pole within the political system, but also the failure of New Democracy to keep the government together following certain events around the election of the President of the Republic. So, in this case, we have Syriza in government following this collapse at around 2015, in the beginning of 2015. And then we have a bit of an additional upheaval. Syriza comes in promising that they will not follow the bailout agreements, that they would tear up the bailout agreements, and eventually that they would follow a pathway outside the shackles of the IMF and the European Union in terms of the obligations that the country had as a result of the crisis. And then, despite all this upheaval, there is a the enforcement of capital controls sometime in April 2015. There is additional uncertainty after the famous referendum of saying no to the bailout agreements later that year. And then Syriza calls a snap election, which it manages to win. Now, what we understand from the results of those two consecutive elections is that Syriza and the coalition government that is currently the small right-wing party of independents survived pretty much without any losses. Okay. And what we've also seen is that, unlike previous occasions, there were fewer protests and fewer reactions towards the imposition of austerity. So Syriza follows through with an austerity program, but at the same time, resistance to austerity starts dropping. So we are intrigued by this kind of phenomenon, not only because of the lower frequency of protests, but also the magnitude of the protests themselves, so in terms of the violence that is around it. There are certain sociological reasons why this may have happened, but let's focus for a second on the issue of accepting or resisting austerity. The point that this paper is trying to make is that it's about populist framing. And what do we know about populist framing? It's not about populism, but about the framing of it, is that it has an ability to attribute blame to other factors. So the more you deflect a responsibility to something else, the easier it is for someone to pass on particular messages. So our research question in this paper is whether the framing of austerity policies affects the way those policies are accepted or rejected by the general public. And the reason why these two pictures are there is because in the first picture, this is Prime Minister Tsipras before the, or in the campaign of the referendum, advocating for a no in the bailout agreements. And here he is in Ithaca announcing the third bailout agreement. So two different pictures. This is after the first time he won. This is after, just before he called the elections. So, what has happened there? Here's a little bit of an impressive picture. I didn't put it up there just to make it fancy. But if we look at those heat maps, progressively since the beginning of the crisis, so we locate that around 2010, protests in Greece have increased. So the number of protests has increased progressively over the years. And it has really taken up the whole country. We also have to note the protests around the islands with Turkey, which is natural since this is the start of the refugee crisis as well. But even with that, what we notice is that despite the protests having increased, they have been lower in scale, in magnitude, in terms of the violence and the damages caused, in terms of the disruption that they caused. Now, if we follow for a second this timeline of the Greek financial crisis up until the early years of the Syriza government, what we actually see, I don't know if this one has it. What we actually see, you know, in the first year of the crisis, just around the memorandum, we have the Indignados of Athens, the famous movement, and then around 2011, when we have the midterm evaluation and the Papadimos government. Here again, with the second memorandum, huge anti-austerity protests that collapse, that push PASOK to collapse, and the elections won by New Democracy. And then protests continue until the first visit by Angela Merkel here, and the gold mine strikes in Chalkidiki. And then we have a quiet period until the murder of the anti-fascist artist by Golden Dawn. And then back again in 2014, we have huge anti-austerity strikes, the second visit from Angela Merkel, the local and European Parliament elections, but also the international fair of Thessaloniki and the anti-fascist protests. Here we have to note the these are the Syrian refugee hunger strikes, so they are accounted for by police records, and also here when they are being removed. But then we have the in-between period, right, between the first elections that Syriza won and the second election. And despite these huge protests around the capital controls days and the referendum, right, we then see a kind of like lull coming on. What is interesting compared to 2012 or 2014 is this sign here, the visit by Barack Obama, okay? If we see that with Angela Merkel's visits, right, huge protests, here we see protests subsiding. And not in terms of the frequency, but in terms of the magnitude. So the scale of the protests starts dropping. So going back to the argument, what was interesting to look at was the supply side of populism. So what we understand is that, okay, there is demand around populism, right? The people want something else. But also political leaders are adopting particular populist framing. And in this case, we identify a framing of a them and us kind of narrative. By populist framing, we call this othering. You're trying to demarcate your territory and identify who the other side is, and you're starting to build coalitions, right? With you or against you. And at the same time, what you do is you identify specific targets, enemies. And both of it can be both internal and external enemies. So it can be some specific social groups within the country or external factors, in this case, the international institutions like the IMF or the European Union. And you do that in order to be able to shift the blame for success or failure or whatever to other targets. Okay. So the argument here is that the way you frame austerity within the economic crisis environment can influence the support or rejection of austerity measures among citizens. So some people will agree more, some people will start disagreeing more. And the reason why a political leader would do that is precisely that othering mechanism that works as a deflection, right? You try to distract people's mind from what's really in front of them, and you are trying to shift the blame elsewhere, engage them in a different way, and so on. We have seen how this works, particularly when we look at Brexit, for example, where in the recent elections there was a lot of deflection, and we saw how that worked out. And then, going back to Greece, we were interested to see whether this kind of deflection or distraction works if you have particular value sets. Okay. So if you belong to the left and you naturally disagree with any sort of austerity cuts, it shouldn't necessarily affect you. You would probably agree that this is a bad measure and you wouldn't go for it, right? And equally, if you are from a neoliberal kind of point of view, then you may be more prone to say, yes, okay, we need to do this. But what happened during the crisis is precisely the collapse of the center, right? And we have plenty of voters who fled to other parties or found themselves politically homeless. And in that sense, a lot of them are being driven by non-ideological cues, right? So they are not looking at the political values that a party may have, but they're looking at their own individual set of values, and they're probably looking at their own pockets as well. Now, the question here, or the story, is that if blame shifting and othering work as mechanisms, then we have expectations being that people will start being less resistant with austerity if the political leader shifts the blame internally to some sort of target for egocentric issues, right? I'll say what these are, or shift the blame externally for sociotropic issues. The reason why we make this split between the two issues is that egocentric issues are the ones that are affecting us individually. So we're looking at our own pockets, we're looking at our own immediate families, relatives, our jobs, right? And we don't really look at the rest of the society. That's an egocentric issue. Sociotropic issues are the ones that are affecting the whole society, right? So society at large is being affected. So it is a condition that you find yourself as an environment that you live in and so on and so forth. So we shift the blame internally for egocentric issues, right? To try and find our direct enemy. And for the state of play of the country, we shift the blame externally. So we try to find an external target. Out of this discussion, we develop 1.5 hypotheses. Now, the first hypothesis has to do with the political values. So if you belong, or if you identify yourself within the left-right continuum somewhere, right, the crisis will not affect your disagreement or agreement with austerity. Okay. That is because you remain true to your own values. But then if you are politically homeless, that means no political party is expressing you at that particular moment, ideologically, then you're likely to accept austerity measures more easily as you see that these are the only way out of a particular situation for your own well-being. And then the second hypothesis has to do with the way that populist framing actually works. We say that those people who have voted one of the populist parties before are being influenced by that message, and they're likely to be supporting that populist framework going forward, right? It's this idea that populism begets more populism, that it becomes a lot more mainstream, and a lot more people are supporting it. And the way that we try to test this out is through a vignette social experiment, where we presented our respondents with some scenarios, okay? Which represented real situations. So we took out some leaders' speeches, and we took out statements from those speeches, which we presented to our respondents. And then what we did there is that we manipulated certain parameters of those speeches in order to, or those quotes, in order to make a treatment experimentally, okay, around the egocentric sociotropic dichotomy. So we asked questions about agreement with pension cuts. That's your egocentric issue, right? And we asked a question around the deeper philosophy of austerity. So austerity as a situation, as a condition in through which the government operates in terms of its spending cuts. So how did we set up the experiment? We thought, the way that Syriza tried to appeal to voters was through precisely the affective side of things. So it was appealing to emotion. And that is really, really important here. Because it is the emotional side that actually prevents people from looking at things in a rational way and making a rational judgment about the impact that a particular measure is going to have on them. Okay. So it used populist framing as a strategy. Okay. And the strategy there was precisely to avoid political costs, so blaming someone else for the situation and trying to maintain itself in power. Okay. That's pretty much standard politics. But in this case, populist framing works very well as a strategy to create this other, to create the narrative of the other. And in terms of othering, it identified its targets. What we expect and what we know is that a left-wing party will identify enemies that belong on the in the economic side of things. Okay. So in this case, the immediate target was the economic elite. So internally, what they did was precisely to identify the oligarchs of the time or the people who had benefited from previous spoils of the system in terms of who ate up the money, famously. Okay. And there was an external elite that was identified on the basis of European and international institutions who were economically driven. Okay. The point there was precisely those neoliberal economic policies that were coming from the top down. And here, precisely in those pictures, we see this kind of division. A protest outside the Greek parliament saying that no home should go to the hands of any bankers. Okay, so that's your internal elite. And the Prime Minister at the time holding a poster of Angela Merkel that says resist against what Angela Merkel is trying to do. Now, so we see this kind of two distinct groups of people that are being targeted by the populist frame. How did we run the experiment? So we employed a local polling agency that could provide us with a representative population. We asked 1,000 participants, stratified sampling. It was carried out between the 5th and the 7th of April in 2017, so that's already 2 years into the first Syriza government, the second Syriza government. And it was we split it in three groups. Okay. Now, the way that experiments work is that you split your sample in groups and you present different cues to the different groups, randomly assigned. So we had almost equal splits, and we presented statements on pensions and statements on austerity as a condition. And here's how the vignette experiment actually worked. Okay. So we have a baseline model where we don't put any populist framing whatsoever. So we took a statement and we presented it to the respondents without any populist framing. So the question went something like this. I would like you to think of a hypothetical country of Europe. This country faces deep fiscal crisis and is forced to undertake reforms in social security, including pension cuts. The governing party announced that reforms are necessary to ensure the viability of pensions in the future. Do you agree or disagree with the statement? And when it came to austerity, we have a similar wording there, with the country facing a deep financial fiscal crisis and is forced to undertake austerity measures, and the governing party announced that austerity is necessary to avoid uncontrolled bankruptcy. Now, for those of you that know a little bit of Greek recent history, contemporary history, these are precisely statements that would resonate with what people would have heard about Greece. And this was intentional, precisely because we wanted to elicit the emotional reaction out of these statements, even at the baseline model. Okay, so we want to put our respondents in a mindset that relates to what they know is happening. Now, in terms of the actual treatment, here's how we introduce the internal enemy. So we have the same statement, right? But towards the end, we say the governing party announced that the organized and established oligarchy is to blame and they will pay, but reforms are necessary to ensure the viability of pensions in the future. And in the case of austerity, it was a similar rephrasing of that statement. Now, we were lucky enough that these actual words had been uttered by the Prime Minister himself, so this was kind of a direct way of framing the populist message. And then again, with the external enemy, the governing party announced that the neoliberal obsessions of the European Union are to blame, but reforms are necessary to ensure the viability of pensions in the future. So you see how we added these treatments to the two groups, okay, beyond the baseline model, making sure that we would be able to capture that populist framing within the question. And now, time for some results. When we look at the pension side of things, what we know is that when you bring up pensions, this is a private matter. Okay? So people are looking at their own pockets, they're looking at their own immediate families. And why we chose it for the case of Greece, you may want to say, you know, unemployment or something else. But because of the situation in Greece, we know that a lot of the family income depends on state pensions. We wanted to make sure that a lot of people would be able to relate, not only pensioners, but also unemployed children of pensioners who are relying on that income to make ends meet. Okay. So if we look at these kinds of results, what we see is that there is a bit of a movement when we introduce the internal enemy, so the internal economic elite. We didn't see that much movement when it came to the external. But what also happened is that compared to the baseline model, that middle category, let me explain here. This side is agreement, this side is disagreement, and the middle category is the neither category, right? Now, that middle category started to fill up with responses, which meant that...
Was it the three-scale thing, or was it...
It was a three-scale thing, based on what the polling company allowed us to do. But it wasn't the forced answer of agreement or disagreement. There was a middle category, right? And what we see is that there was this kind of fill-up of this middle category with the internal enemy priming. When we looked at austerity, this was the interesting bit, we see practically no movement. Okay. So at first, we actually thought that the experiment hadn't really worked. So we decided to take a deep dive and look at the particular groups that we had identified early on. The voters that identified themselves on the left-right continuum somehow, and the voters that identified themselves as having no ideological attachment. Why the non-ideological voters were important? What we noticed out of our questionnaire was the fact that when people were asked to place themselves on the left-right scale on a 1 to 10 scale, there was an impromptu answer of these things don't matter anymore. And there was about 10 or 12% of the whole sample that identified themselves as left-right doesn't matter anymore. Okay. So it's quite a considerable amount of people that don't identify themselves as ideologically driven. So when we bring up the left-right continuum, okay, and looking at pensions, what we see at the baseline model is that where you position yourself matters in terms of your agreement or disagreement with austerity. So the idea here is that the more left you are, the more likely you are to disagree with austerity. So that's kind of self-evident. So what happened when we started introducing the enemies, we started seeing the movement of this variable towards this side and here on this side as well, which doesn't give us a statistical significance about the movement, but it tells us that when we introduce enemies, people are starting to get distracted. Okay? So their decision-making ability is distracted. So they cannot really make up their mind between their ideological passion, okay, the more left you are, the more likely you are to disagree with these measures, but they start thinking about that neither category, and this is why we saw that kind of movement. When we look at the issues around austerity as a condition, again, we see a particular, similar kind of movement when we introduce the internal and the external enemy. So this kind of muddling of the variables is quite intriguing in terms of an argument, of what it's trying to do. Now, when we look at the actual non-ideological voters, okay, we call them cynical voters, those who say that left and right don't matter anymore. What we see is that if you are a cynical voter, you vote with what your pocket tells you. Okay, so you are likely to agree more with austerity measures, seeing them as a way of getting out of a difficult situation. So when we in the baseline model, but when we introduce the internal enemy, the effect is much stronger. Okay. When we introduce the external enemy for pensions, the effect was not there. So populist priming for external enemies had no significance. How do you mean specific examples?
Well, could you just, you say things have moved. Could you give us an example of what has moved, how, and where?
People's responses have moved. So, this is a group.
To what? I mean, I can see a zero, and I can see things which are to the left of the zero, but it's difficult, it's not terribly easy to see.
Sure, these are statistical measures, right? So, what we need to have is our variables, which are here with the red, right, be either on this side or on that side, right? But this space cannot really be on both sides, right? When it's either on this side or that side, that means this variable has statistical significance. Okay. If you see it moving, right? So for example, this is not a good chart to show you this, but say this one.
Education is a good example, maybe.
Education. Yeah. So you see, there we go. Education, the spread of responses, right, goes before zero and after zero. That means it's not statistically significant. But when we start introducing an internal enemy in the picture, the responses are shifting. You see this dot here, right? But it still has no statistical significance. Here, the margin between responses becomes even smaller when we introduce the external enemy, but it still maintains statistical insignificance. So the only variable that has a statistical significance in this case is the left-right side and the economic voting, which is not applicable in our argument at the moment. Okay, but follow the left-right side. Okay, so this is all the way on the other side of zero, right? And here it's getting muddled. Right. So our results are not statistically significant. People start to get confused when you are bringing in the internal enemy between their ideological cues and their agreement or disagreement with the particular statement that we presented to them.
But sorry, I mean, it's still, I mean, I'm looking at it like this, but almost everything its confidence interval is touching the zero. And almost everything is concentrated somewhere between zero and 0.25. Now, since I don't exactly know what 0.25 is relative to 0.5 or 1, it's difficult. If I look at economic voting, I mean, they're all a bit, they're all somewhere a bit up from,
well, this is above zero, so.
0.5 centered on about.
This is above zero.
Yeah, yeah.
So that means the more better off you are, the more likely you are to agree with austerity. Okay.
I know that's a, you know, a 12% coefficient with the 3 stars next to it. So it is non-zero. 3 stars. Okay, let's continue and we'll go back to this.
And it will make sense once you see the whole picture. Okay. So if you are a cynical voter and you're looking at pensions, you are more likely to agree with austerity when an internal enemy is being brought forward. But not with the external enemy. And again, a similar effect for austerity as a general condition. So we see that for our cynical voters, it is really the internal argument that plays out quite well rather than the external attribution of blame. Finally, looking at propensity to vote. So if you have the propensity to vote for one of the parties that we have available on a scale from 0 to 10, how likely are you to vote in the next election for this party? And we look at pension cuts. What you see here is that the only two parties or supporters, right, parties that stay true to their ideological kind of drive are the Communist Party. Okay? So they kind of disagree with everything. Okay. And the voters who would support the river, okay, which was a more neoliberal type of party.
Sorry, but to the right is that they agree with the austerity.
In this case.
So the Communist Party agrees with the austerity. And
No. In this case, it's the reverse.
Okay.
Because the scale is different. When we introduce the internal enemy, though, what we observe is that Syriza voters start agreeing with austerity. And when we introduce the external with pension cuts, I'm sorry. And when we introduce the external enemy, we also see supporters of the independent Greeks starting to agree. Now that makes sense if we consider that they both had an external, a clearly identified external target, which is the EU, okay, as Eurosceptic parties. And we have a similar picture when it comes to austerity as a condition. Okay. So both in the internal enemy and in the external enemy, we pick up supporters of Syriza, okay, which are likely to accept austerity measures if they are projected both against an internal and an external enemy. So that kind of verifies our original idea that populism begets more populism. So if you are convinced by the message, you are likely to agree with what your party is telling you should happen. So going back to the hypothesis, when we're looking at the left-right positioning, left-wing oriented citizen oppose austerity of all kinds in the baseline model, but populist priming manages to bring down this ideological drive when it enters the picture. Not in all cases. And in this case, we are interested in the non-ideological voters, and we see that they are likely to accept austerity measures more easily in egocentric and sociotropic elements, but only when they are projected against an internal enemy. In this case, it seems that this external argument, that it's the you to blame, does not really work for those who don't have any ideological drives. And also, when we're looking at government supporters, while in the baseline model, we see that people are following certain ideological drives, when populist frames are introduced, they accept both types of measures. Okay. So in conclusion, the purpose of this whole story was precisely to say that in times of crisis, something magical happens. People don't think rationally, right? And therefore, their positioning on the left-right continuum becomes a bit irrelevant in their minds when populist framing is brought in, because they're also overtaken by the sensationalism of things. Okay? So populist framing does manage to confuse people, manages to distract people, manages to muddle their schedule of preferences, right? And this is also how populist strategy actually works. Okay? And in this case, what happened is that the collapse of the traditional left and right in Greece created this pool of homeless, politically homeless voters. And in this case, they were not driven by any ideological cues. We call them cynical. And we saw that they were more susceptible to this populist crime. And also, as a final kind of conclusion, is that we noticed that populism is a good alibi, or this othering is a good alibi for those who have already supported or are likely to support governing parties that have this this populist strategy, who may have disagreed in principle with austerity, right? But they are not disagreeing anymore. Now, as a follow-up to this work, we're trying to look into specific social groups, so if there was any effect between men and women, between younger and older populations, but also in terms of profession and employment or unemployment. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sam. Right, I have a couple of questions for clarifications as you collect your thoughts and you prepare your questions. So the results you showed us, are they kind of unconditional differences of means, or you the elasticities that you get from the graph? So do you control for the individual characteristics?
Yes.
You do? Mm-hmm. Okay. In that sense, then, do you know what, you know, all the different, you know, the left, right, and the ages, the age, education, and the other covariates that you showed, do they have specific patterns in the?
The only variable that was actually significant was education. So if you had not been through many years of education, you were likely to agree more easily with the populist message.
Okay.
Which makes perfect sense. Yeah. And the other one was economic voting. So, you know, what do you think the economic condition of the country would be in the near future? And so if you were saying, oh, it's going to be worse, you were likely to say against it. Yeah.
Okay, so the other point is that I'm not sure how clean the vignette, you know, the treatment is. Mm-hmm. In the sense that you still ask the question, do you agree or disagree with the policy? Mm-hmm. But in the baseline scenario, the policy is, do you agree with cuts? Mm-hmm. In the treatment scenario, you ask, do you agree that we punish the plutocrats mm-hmm. and do cuts? So it is not the same question. It is not like that, you know, you make a positive statement that we will punish the plutocrats. Do you agree with the cuts? Mm-hmm. You say, do you agree with the policy? So how clean was that?
And so in the baseline model, what we try to do is to strip back any sort of populist framing for the issue.
So it was a very clean statement. You know, we are forced to take up these measures so we don't go bankrupt, or we don't, or we maintain the sustainability of pensions in the future. What we noticed, though, in the statements that were presented as political speeches by the Prime Minister, he would bring the two together as a conditional thing. So, on the one hand, it is the oligarchs to blame and they will pay, but, sorry, we're going to have to take those reforms. So,
like you see, like, if I really hate the oligarchs, yeah, I may be willing to take up austerity just in order to
precisely, that was the point, yeah. Though, to create this enemy in your mind when thinking about the question. So on the one hand, if you hated the oligarchs, you would know it was the oligarchs' fault, right? If you hated the European Union for doing this, you would know precisely in the statement that this is about the European Union's involvement in Greek politics. So precisely the priming was following the populist strategy or the communication strategy that Syriza was trying to bring forward in that time of the experiment.
No, I definitely understand as priming, yeah. Definitely, yes. And you mentioned the EU or the plutocrats and stuff. And I'm just saying whether it changed the nature of the question, because the question, at least in the slide, I don't know in the question how it was, it wasn't do you agree with the pension cuts, it was like do you agree with the policy, and then the policy as a policy
I think
is
we
different.
Had it because this is directly translated, so we asked them to focus on the policy, right?
Yeah.
So,
but the policy in the baseline is cuts, and the policy in the treatment is penalize the plutocrats and or you know,
I think,
make them pay.
I think in Greek is more, it's clearer how the thing is framed, because it's asking about the actual policy of pension cuts. Okay, or imposing further austerity. Okay, so in this case, I mean, in the Greek version, it's probably much clearer. In the English version, it gets muddled. But
because the policy to make the rich pay, you
no, it's
agree
not. It's not that policy.
If you also yeah, okay.
Because
yeah.
In the question it says, the government is forced to undertake reforms in social security, including pension cuts. So
yeah,
do you agree with that
policy?
Policy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
But in this case, your way of thinking is probably the way that someone would also respond back to the question. And this is the reason why we see a lot of them going to the neither category, because they cannot really make up their mind whether they want the oligarchs to pay more than having their pension cut.
Yeah.
Or pay and not have more austerity measures, right? So this is precisely the kind of muddling that we try to recreate in the experiment conditions in order to be able to bring people in that mindset of not being able to decide between their rational side of things, okay, between their ideological values and what they actually feel at that point in time, against these particular targets.
Okay, I'll open it up for questions. Bernard?
Two questions. One, a very simple question.
Those are the worst. Those are the worst.
Yeah, complex answer.
Who actually paid for this? Because this involved some costs for a field agency.
Yeah. It costs about 8,000 euros. Hmm? It cost about 8,000 euros. Eight.
Yeah, I mean, no. So I was just going to ask who did pay for it. That was a simple
question. Our university did.
Your university?
Yeah.
Okay.
We bid for some money. We got the money. We ran the survey.
I just wondered whether anybody had an interest in the subject. Okay. The other question, which comes back to what I was asking earlier. As it stands, maybe if I already did, reasonably competent econometrician and so forth, it was not easy to actually follow what was going on in those charts. And one of the things which I kept on seeing was that everybody seemed to be, if they weren't quite on the zero line, they were extremely close to the zero line, and very often, you know, they're overlapping between the three different categories.
Well, there's little I can do for the actual graphs because it was marginal to zero,
yeah, but
right?
Consequent on the fact that the numbers actually drop below approximately 300 and something each time, which again means how far can you go in analyzing subcategories?
Mm-hmm. Right, so these are the 1,000 questionnaires that were complete. Okay.
Oh, so there were some who didn't complete.
We don't care about those. These are by default out of the sample, right? But our sampling strategy was to try and evenly split the groups between the three treatments, right? The baseline model and the two treatments. Now, obviously, the 300-something that's still in the group is still a statistically significant number, right, in terms of drawing valid inferences out of it. What we think is... the effect will be, well, when we break it down to smaller groups, there will still be some significance when we're looking at the male-female division, okay, because this is an almost 50-50 split in this case. We will have more trouble justifying the results if we break it down to younger populations or specific groups. But we still want to see whether there is an indication that there is something going on that can probably merit further research when it comes to bringing up a group full of these particular people from this particular group, if you see what I mean. So I'm not sure.
I'm terribly keen. I mean, I love spending my time actually showing not that something happened, but something didn't happen, despite the fact that people think it might.
Mm-hmm.
I developed a reputation over many years for actually showing, not making discoveries, but what somebody in the Financial Times once wrote about as he, and it was me who was referred to, as doing coverings. In other words, I'm wondering how much comes out of this that actually there was not very much happening, as opposed to, in other words, there were no differences as much as the fact that there were some differences. But I don't know how far you can go with that.
We cannot go really deep down in the specific groups because, as you said, it's broken down in very small numbers and we cannot draw statistical significance. So we have to treat it at the aggregate level, and this is probably the reason why the movements are not that huge, because what we originally know from the baseline model is that given the situation in Greece at the time, because this is 2017, where people have endured a very long time of austerity, very long time of back-to-back cuts, what you experience is huge disagreement anyway.
Yeah, so, I mean, the
right?
question then becomes, did you actually expect more and you got less than you expected,
no.
which might be...
No, we didn't. We were not surprised by the original findings. So when we saw the frequencies in the responses, we were not surprised precisely because when we asked the question, we made it intentional that people could relate their experience at the moment as a country facing economic difficulty and being forced to take particular measures to any other country, right? So we wanted to intentionally bring up the emotional side of the respondent, and we were expecting that we would see a lot of disagreement, right? We were surprised with only one result, and that was the external enemy. Precisely because of the strength that Syriza had as a Eurosceptic party, both within the European elections 2 years before that and in the second series of government, we were expecting to see the external enemy working for the ideological side of things. That was unexpected, right? And what we understand is that Syriza was trying to develop a two-pronged strategy of having both an internal enemy and an external enemy in their narrative at the same time. So when they were speaking to the public, they would start off with the internal oligarchy and the elites, the banks, this and that and the other, and at the same time they would try to link that to the European side. Oh, it's Merkel, it's Germany, it's the IMF, it's Christine Lagarde, whoever, right, at the time. So that kind of two-pronged strategy was aiming to capture voters or supporters that are driven ideologically differently towards these targets, right? And be able to increase their pool of supporters. What we found, and this was the surprising bit, was that the external enemy had run its course. Yeah. So it was not relevant anymore in 2017. Okay, so we need to contextualize it to when this happened. But the internal enemy was still there. And there is an assumption that we can make, which is that, for example, the reforms that had been taken so far had not managed to tackle things like tax evasion or bring people into justice for those who had embezzled money from the public purse, so on and so forth. So that kind of discussion was still very live. But the European discussion had subsided. So in the two-pronged strategy, the message here is choose your enemy carefully, right? Because if you focus only on the external, you lose the argument. If you focus on the internal, you win the argument, right? Yes, of course, as with everything in political science, right?
Just to follow up on that, I think you need to spend much more time saying that, because this has been shown already in a way. You know, there are, I mean, we found the same in our paper last year with Vasiliki, that by 2017 the parliamentary discourse had completely changed, that there was no external enemy in the discourse anymore. So even Syriza was not using it. So you need to explain that there's something there about the timing. But of course this then means that what you're trying to do cannot be generalized as much. And you have to justify why you need an experiment to say that. You know, because you could say
different means.
So then maybe the question is, what more does this experiment bring to you? So was it a worrying method? And what is novel about what you found that it's really interesting for us to look at this period of austerity and
Can I respond?
Yeah.
I think the novelty is about the populist framing as a political strategy, right? So how you use particular language in order to be able to sway people for your side or against someone else. Now, in this case, what we understand, and this is, I think, the important bit, is the composition of voters of Syriza, right? They are not ideologically driven by the radical left message. So Syriza is making a wide catch of different types of voters who belonged to different political families before the crisis hit. So the message is trying to capture voters using a particular populist framing in order to increase support, maintain themselves in power. So they have to be more open about it, and they have to speak with something that is wider. Obviously, in the paper, there is a lot more contextual explanation of the experiment and the actual timing of the experiment, where we actually explain this is midway through Syriza's term in office. And there is also a lot of disagreement already with the policies that Syriza had brought forward in the minds of people. So in terms of using the experiment, it was a rewarding method because we were able to strip back the political side of things and talk about the actual policies with specific targets. And that means that whoever brings those targets or enemies will probably have a similar kind of reaction by voters. This is what we can say at the time. Okay. And this goes back to other anecdotal evidence that we have from, say, the European institutions, that they work better with Syriza in government than with PASOK or New Democracy when it came to reforms. So they found it more easy. They found it easier for Syriza to process reforms than the previous guys, simply because they were able to make this kind of deflection and distraction in people's schedules of preferences. We can disagree, yeah, of course.
Can I follow up from Stella and then I'll come to you for this question? I'm a bit sort of uncomfortable with how you move between the experiment and the kind of real life explanations, what you said about the timing of it, and you know how you when you were saying populism and sometimes you're saying the populism of Syriza and stuff, because the experiment is supposed to be clean of that, yeah? So the experiment is supposed to decontextualize things and see how kind of people cognitively respond to things. So if people were really, you know, you were showing them this, but they were thinking, you know, specific politicians in specific places, you know, giving speeches and stuff, then basically you reproduce, you know, you might as well ask them, how do you feel about Tsipras? You know, because you're not asking the question that is on the PowerPoint, you're asking the question that they understand. Mm-hmm. So in general, what you would want to do is to make it as decontextualized as possible. So, and I'm, as a kind of quantitative person, I'm quite happy to accept that this is sufficiently decontextualized. Mm-hmm. But then in the discussion, you do present it as something very, very, you know, context specific. And, you know, by 2017, they had come to terms with A or whatever. So that's part A of my question. And then part B is that because then in reality, we know a number of other things played a role as well. Yes, so, you know, if you have a spectrum of whatever, 5-6 parties, and you try all of them, at the last party, you run out of opposition. You know, at some point, you will just accept fate and say, okay, you know, we'll do this. You know, we'll implement austerity, stop demonstrating. Or also the thing that then, you know, I mean, okay, the economy didn't pick up hugely, but it stopped dropping. Mm-hmm. And it does make a difference, you know? So when it declines by 5% per year or 7% per year, or it is at zero, mm-hmm. it feels like growth. So you know, there's a number of explanations why you would think the intensity of demonstrations, you know, what you had in the motivation, subsided. So if we were doing the kind of, you know, real-life empirical analysis, and of course you could factor these things in. In the experiment, you don't want to factor these things in. You want to see whether priming, a kind of populist priming with, you know, the very nicely put, you know, the internal and the external, whether it works. So going back to my A question, what is the balance then? You know, do we want to contextualize that, or want to present as something which is...
We really wanted to focus on left-wing populist framing. Okay, so this is the rationale of the paper. We want to find out why Syriza was successful in bringing forward particular austerity measures while at the same time expressing a very strong anti-austerity message. That is the starting point of our rationale. Okay, now it's very clear from the experiment that we are asking about the exclusion that is being made from the populist side of, from the populist point of view, on the basis of the economy. Okay, and that's a left-wing message. We could have also done an experiment to see the right-wing approach, and this would have been then, you know, immigration. So the ethnic divide, right? So populism of the left excludes on the basis of the economy. Populism of the right excludes on the basis of ethnicity or of ethnic divisions. Now, it would make things a lot more complicated, but our point was to try and see how Syriza managed to sustain power, okay, reduce the protest, make people agree with a particular type of measures. So the interesting bit is you have a prime minister in early 2015 that comes up and says, we're going to tear out the bailout agreements. And then 9 months down the road or 8 months down the road, he signs a third bailout agreement and people don't protest about it. Why have they accepted austerity? It's a matter of accepting your fate. Unlikely. That's why if we see that from 2015 to 2017, which people have the time to absorb what is happening, so austerity measures come into force, people start to see the impact it has in their pockets, maybe they see the impact on the economy and so on. So 2017 is still relevant. Okay, so we're trying to figure out why the support for the party still was quite high in 2017, and people were not protesting to the same extent or reacting to the same extent as they were in 2012 or in 2013 or even in 2015 with the capital controls.
Yes, but you want to say that populist framing matters, mm-hmm. and it is not my explanations about accepting your fate and stuff, but it's at least to some extent it is populist framing, and that's why you do the
experiment. But this is...
So then why do you go back and say... Yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit
well, we're also trying to make a discussion here and connect a lot of different things, right? Because this is not supposed to be the presentation of the paper, but also discuss
wider issues. If it matters, then I would want it to matter all years, not only 2017, because
the problem. The problem with experiments is the fact that, if you repeat them, they have an issue with external validity, right? Okay, that is acceptable. Yeah, we know it as a method. Therefore, we're trying to contextualize the conclusions of the experiment in a way that is meaningful to understand or to explain certain behaviors by the voting population. So for us, yes, it is an assumed behavior based on the experiment. What people actually do in 2017, we couldn't know because there was no election. So we take this as a temperature check. Now, we can replicate the experiment, we can run another survey, but the conditions have changed. So we may find completely different results with, say, New Democracy in power right now, and the way that voters have shifted their focus.
So I won't label the point anymore, but that's where my problem comes, because what you want is, if I run an experiment to see whether people... sort of images of mothers suffering affect people's preference for the distribution. Mm-hmm. I don't want this experiment to be dependent on who is in government.
Which is the reason why...
Because it's a general question about...
Which is the reason why there is no reference to the Prime Minister inside the experiment. And the module that of our questions that was attached to the main questionnaire was not asking anything about political leaders. It was a plain questionnaire about voting intentions, that's fair enough, economic outlook, and emotional state of play. So there was a question about how you feel nowadays, angry, happy, and so on. But there was nothing else around the questionnaire that would be able to elicit that this is a statement by Tsipras. The only thing that we did was take out specific words from one statement in the Thessaloniki International Trade Fair, and insert it as the treatment inside the question, just to bring up to people's mind this kind of narrative of the oligarchs or of the European Union. But there's nothing else that has been associated with a particular party or in the question. And as you see, the actual scenario talks about a hypothetical country in Europe. Right.
Yeah, so, okay, that nobody bought.
Of course, but the idea is not to say your country is facing a problem and your government has announced this policy. So effectively, you're trying to strip it down to no references to a particular name of a leader or of a party. So to that point, the experiment is solid. How much you can replicate that, I mean, even with pictures of mothers and social redistribution,
always works.
I would doubt it, especially if you bring the left-right side.
All right, this is a question from over there.
I want to ask you two questions. The first one is related to what you were discussing about the difference in the connection between the methodology and the goal of the paper. So what I don't know is, it's so important to know why does it work? So why is the question general terms, because it's possible to agree in this general statement in abstract terms, but somehow the specific categorization that could be make about who is the oligarch here, who is the people, who is the innocent, who's not, seems to be out of the general frame, seems to be part of another procedure. So maybe if people agree about, for instance, the second description, when they are not going to agree about the specific party or the specific category in the real world, is being part of that. So that's the first issue. And the other one, it's about the definition of populism. Because I don't know, because of what I heard, it seems to be the idea of the enemy, and also the using emotions as a rhetoric strategy. Sure. But what else? Because if it's only two of these two elements, it seems very similar to democracy, and in that point maybe it's a very normative concept. It's essentially a normative component. It's relevant, but I think that could be dangerous, because somehow there is an implicit choice in terms of the...
How do you mean an implicit choice?
I mean an implicit choice because there is like a core concept, a core component in the concept, which is normative. So it's like there is a good way of doing it and a bad way. And the ones who are using emotions and are creating enemies, which are
okay,
fake.
I get you. Okay, so basically, the point of the paper was not to engage with a debate about what populism is and what populism isn't, or whether it is a good thing for democracy or a bad thing for democracy. That's a very nice political theory debate between Kasmude and Laclanov, right? Okay, this is the this implicit choice that you're mentioning is precisely the debate that they are having. What we're saying is that populism works, and they all agree on two mechanisms: othering, so demarcating who the other side is, and identifying enemies. So we're only picking up those elements to be able to justify the logic behind the paper. So we don't really engage with the debate of whether populism is good for democracy or bad for democracy, or whether it is a helpful thing or an unhelpful thing to citizens. We're just saying populism exists, okay, and it has a strategy. And we're interested in finding out whether the strategy itself has an impact on the way that people think about particular policies that, generally speaking, are considered bad. Cutting down on social welfare, cutting down on government spending, and affecting particular types of population in times of crisis is considered a bad thing, right? So we're not necessarily interested in defining populism again. We take a working definition, okay, very thin definition of populism in this case, because we're actually interested only in bringing out the othering side and the blame shifting. Does that...
Goal. Why do you suppose that just because people agree in this general statement, then it explains that it actually works? Because we could agree about...
Because that's why we have the comparison between the three groups then. One group has not seen any populist framing. It's a pretty straight...
The baseline.
Oops. That doesn't work. So if you see the baseline model, it has no populist framing whatsoever, right? Country faces a fiscal crisis, forced to undertake measures of social security reform. The governing party announces that reforms are necessary to ensure the viability of pensions in the future. Pretty fact-based statements, right? And we compare this, maybe this works now, with bringing in the populist framing in the form of an internal enemy. So people are now primed to respond to this question with this statement in mind, or the external enemy, right, which is the European Union in this case. And what we do is precisely compare the three groups and how they react. Okay.
And what we're trying to explain here is precisely what you're saying in terms of the how people react to this. It's precisely these middle categories that start filling up Twitter, so people don't really make up their mind. And this is why we say populist priming works. Because if the purpose of populist priming is to confuse people in order to deflect, right, or distract them from the actual problem, which is the state of the economy and the future of the country, right, by blaming X, Y, or Z, then it has worked. It's not only about agreeing, but also moving to that neither category where you cannot really make up your mind. Does that make sense?
Okay. Another question from
my kind of two-part question. One is on the greater contribution. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so on the basis of the experiment, we cannot really make any generalizations, right? That is a methodological trade-off. You do an experiment, you have conclusions about this experiment and no other. Okay, so in terms of the greater contribution, I think the contribution is more towards understanding how the mechanisms of populist framing work. Okay, so try to figure out what plays in people's head. And if you combine this with the second paper that has come out of this research, which is on the emotional side, right, there can be certain conclusions about attitudes towards particular actors. So there is reactions to the internal elites in terms of blame, and there is reactions towards European integration support and so on and so forth. So there is a bit of a combination of the two in order to make sense of the wider contributions. I haven't done it yet, okay, patience. In terms of the paradigms, yes, the point here is that if we see the way that the support for the party has not really collapsed, right, so in the latest set of the elections, the party maintains not the same, but similar levels of support in terms of its voter base, right? That means that for the supporters of this party, we are going towards this kind of discussion, right? So if you believe the message of this particular party, you're likely to accept what it does, and you're likely to support them in the future. So this is a way of consolidating voter base. So if there is a paradigm for later and you are a left-wing party that's trying to make it through to the general population, you better have identified a good internal enemy, right? And also have managed to muddle people's preferences. So in terms of the contribution, it's about a political communication. Okay.
Is not one of the most centrist. There are some kind of layers of a little bit of relation towards the right. How does that reflect within
you see, in the case of the coalition, Syriza was handling the economy under their agreement. So all economic policies were emanating from Syriza personnel, political personnel, ministers and so on and so forth, and advisors. Now, the reason why, for example, in this case we see the external enemy working quite well is precisely because, in the case of the independent Greeks, you are looking at a right-wing party which excludes on the basis of national sovereignty, ethnic divides, migration, and so on. So their target is the European Union, but for another reason, right? For liberal immigration policies and not doing anything about the refugees and so on, right? So in this case, it works in a complementary way. But if we identify the internal enemy, it doesn't work, precisely because when it comes to the economy, they had completely different points of view. But in the working of the coalition, it was Syriza that was making the economic decisions, right? The fact that there is a demise of the independent Greeks in the 2019 elections is a whole different story, and it can be explained through a lot of different points of view, right? I think it was 2018 when they started clashing, really. Because even when they signed the third memorandum and then following some reforms and some protests, I think there was no really, they were seeing them hand in hand all the time. It was really at the end of 2018 and the beginning of 2019, or in that first quarter of 2019, that the breakup of the coalition showed up, right? And it was later, before the summer, that Syriza made a clean break with the coalition and left them on their own, called the snap election, lost it, sure, but with, in terms of support, with not significant downgrading. I mean, there is nothing that could probably give us trended data, right? Apart from public opinion polls that ask questions around those issues. So questions about support for European Union membership or support for the euro would be indicative of the political environment across time, okay? But there are studies that are looking at they are doing content analysis of political speeches and party manifestos. Yes, in discourse analysis, I think your paper, Stella, is doing that. The one with Vasiliki, yeah. And we have an older paper with Daphne Halkiopoulou and Sofia Vasilopoulou from 2014. That looked at party leader speeches within parliament between 2009 and 2012. Out of that paper, I can tell you that we were already seeing the exclusionary strategy of Syriza. It was the only party at 3% back then that was being fully exclusive in terms of its blame towards other actors. So it was blaming not only the governing party, the opposition party, but everybody else in the system, in the political system. And that included special interest groups, external actors, the EU specifically, and so on. So it already has a fully fledged exclusionary strategy since 2009,
which if you see it, how it evolved in 2012, when it started to become a significant political power, you start seeing the development and the capturing of the voter with this kind of left-wing populist narrative. We also saw that as an expression in the referendum, right? Where the majority voted for no, but at the same time, they were still in favor of European Union membership and in favor of the euro. So you see the kind of confusion that goes on inside people's mind at that time, right? Depending on the question that they're being asked.
You can still go for
sure, more. Yeah, yeah.
So I think we could take one more question. Yeah.
Right. The indication that we have is precisely the kind of absence of any losses between the two elections, right? So at the time of when you have strong capital controls, when the country is at the brink of bankruptcy and expulsion from the European Union, you still have voters voting for the same, with the same intensity for the same party, right? So between the, in those 9 months, nothing has really changed. Despite being a very hard, so it could be easy. It could have been easy for another party to come up and say, "Oh, all these guys are, you know, fooling you and doing this and that and the other," and capitalize on the referendum. But the emotion there was strong, so people are siding, and the fact that Syriza managed to maintain power for the full 4 years, right? It may have been an early election, but it wasn't that early, okay? So they went from September to September, right? And at the same time, what's interesting to see is to follow public opinion polls before the election. There is a period of time when New Democracy is leading way too much, and then from about 2 to 3 weeks before the actual vote, Tsipras is taking the whole party on his shoulders, excluding everybody else. He's the only one appearing on television, for example, or making statements, or doing hardcore campaigning, and he manages to bring back the party support to about 30%. Yeah.
So do you think going forward?
So it is sustainable. The fact that it's no longer in power, that's an outcome of democracy, right?
Yeah.
One goes, one stays behind. But if you try to maintain this kind of political strategy, you may be able to capitalize on the failures of New Democracy going forward and return yourself in power.
But it's not necessarily a strategy to expand your base.
Depends on what happens in the future,
yeah.
Right? But the point here is that in 2019, in terms of the election, the announcement is that Syriza is trying to be a more wider umbrella party, right? In terms of a more standard mainstream party rather than a radical party in its own right. Okay, so it's still trying to consolidate itself to cover that left to center ground.
Okay, I think we have to stop
sure.
here. Before I ask the audience to thank you the usual way, let me do two announcements. So our next seminar is on Tuesday, 4th of February. I believe that's in 2 weeks' time, approximately. We'll have Pascal Savanitidis from the University of Thessaly speaking on immigrant and refugee segregation dynamics. And then on the 25th of February, again Tuesday, Apostolis Philippopoulos from the Athens University of Economics and Business is going to talk on economic growth in Greece, barriers and prospects. So you're welcome to join in both events. Please now join me in thanking Thavans for his presentation and discussion.
Thank you.